Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Good evening, everybody. Is the, I think it's working, it's working. Okay, today we will be studying Sutta number 44 in the Majjhima Nikaya. This is called the Chula Vedala Sutta. Yeah, the title of this discourse is a little bit obscure. The word chula means shorter, and it's usually contrasted with another sutta. When it's given as the name of a sutta, it's almost always contrasted with another sutta, which is called maha, the greater or longer version. And so in the Majjhima Nikaya, we have Sutta number 43, which is called the Mahavedala Sutta, the greater Vedala Sutta, the longer one. And this one is the Chula Vedala Sutta, the shorter one. What's a little problematic is the word Vedala, or I think it's Vedala. Since we don't know the exact meaning of this word, but it seems to me, this is just my own hypothesis, that it's derived from the word Veda, the word Veda was given to the names of the Brahminic scriptures, the Vedas, but the word Veda itself means knowledge. And so it strikes me that perhaps these two suttas have the name Vedala because they're concerned with, we call these subtle points of knowledge. But what is common to both of these suttas is that they take the form of dialogues in which one person asks subtle and a bit technical, doctrinal questions to another person who gives the answers. In the Mahavedala Sutta, the dialogue is between the Venerable Sariputta. In the Mahavedala Sutta, the longer version, the dialogue is between the Venerable Sariputta and another monk named Mahakotita. In this sutta, the dialogue is between a lay follower named Visakha and the bhikkhuni named Dhammadina. Both these suttas have counterparts in the Chinese Zhonghanjing. That's the Chinese translation of the Madhyamaka Agama. In the Madhyamaka Agama, the Zhonghanjing, the Chula Vedala Sutta counterpart is Sutta number 210, and the Mahavedala counterpart is Sutta number 211. The order is the opposite of the order in which they are found in the Pali, Majjhima Nikaya. In the Chula Vedala Sutta, the chief speaker, you could say, the one who gives the answers, is a bhikkhuni, that's a Buddhist nun, whose name is Dhammadina. And among the lists of eminent disciples that occurs in the Anguttara Nikaya, in the Anguttara Nikaya there is a section where the Buddha assigns, first, he has a number of categories of eminent monks, and then he appoints individual monks to as the most eminent in those particular categories. And then that is followed by a section of eminent nuns, and he appoints individual nuns as being the most eminent in those qualities. And then it's followed by a section of eminent male lay disciples and a section of women lay disciples. And in the section on the most eminent nuns, Dhammadina is appointed as the nun who is most eminent as a preacher or expounder of the Dhamma. Unfortunately, even though the Buddha appointed her to that category, in the whole collection of suttas that's come down, we have only one sutta spoken by Dhammadina, which is this sutta here. So I think there may also be some poems by her in the Terigata. Okay, and then in this sutta, Dhammadina is in a conversation or discussion with a male lay follower whose name is Visakha. Actually, in the Chinese version of the sutta, the person in dialogue with Dhammadina is said to be the female disciple, Visakha. But I have to say, I think the Chinese version has made a mistake here, because there was a very famous female lay disciple of the Buddha whose name was Visakha, ending with the long A. And she occurs in many suttas, whereas the lay follower Visakha, I think, occurs only in this sutta. And so it seems because the female disciple Visakha was very famous, that in the Chinese version, the name Visakha was understood to be the name of the female disciple. But actually, the female disciple Visakha, when she has a discussion with the Buddha, it's usually about topics like offering alms, about how to lead a happy family life, how to look after the needs of monks and nuns, how to achieve merits and a happy rebirth. Whereas the questions here deal with very subtle and intricate points of Buddhist philosophy. And so it seems very unlikely that the female lay disciple Visakha would have been asking those questions. The Pali commentary to the sutta gives a little background story, or a little story that provides the background to this conversation. According to the Pali commentary, in lay life, Visakha and Dhammadina had been husband and wife. Apparently they didn't have any children, at least no children are mentioned. But Visakha had heard about the Buddha and went to listen to the Buddha preach. And while he was listening to the Buddha preach, his mind became deeply absorbed in the teaching. And even, I think, in the course of the Buddha's discourse or at the end of the Buddha's discourse, he attained realization and he became an anagami, a non-returner. And one characteristic of the non-returner is that he's free from sensual desire. He has no more, not even a trace of sensual craving. And so Visakha realized that because he achieved the stage of non-returna, that he was no longer capable of engaging in normal marital relations with his wife. And so when he returned home, he told Dhammadina, first he kept some distance from Dhammadina. He didn't come up to her and embrace her and kiss her, but he just said hello in a somewhat detached way. And so Dhammadina was a little puzzled, what is going on? And he continued to act and to keep a little distance. And so then Dhammadina asked him, why are you treating me in this way? Is it that you don't love me anymore? And then Visakha said, well, I have to tell you what happened to me today. There's this famous spiritual teacher that they call the Buddha. He's living near Rajagaha. And so I went to hear him preach. I listened to his discourse, meditated on it, and I've become a non-returner. I've eradicated sensual craving. And so we can no longer live together in the normal way as husband and wife, but I don't want to impose on you. You can do whatever you want. If you want to stay at home and just live together with me like brother and sister, friend and friend, we can do that. If you want to return home to your parents, you can go back home. If you want to find another husband and get married again, you can do that. The choice is yours. Then Dhammadina asked him, is it possible for women to also follow this teaching of this Buddha? And Visakha said yes. And so Visakha said yes. Dhammadina went to hear the Buddha preach. She was delighted with the Buddha's teaching. She saw that there were monks and nuns. And then she decided that she wanted to become a bhikkhuni, a nun. So then she came back home to Visakha and told him that she would like to go forth as a nun in the Buddha's, as a member of the Buddha's Sangha. And then she asked Visakha for permission. And Visakha, as an anagami, he was delighted by this. And so he made all of the arrangements for his wife to take ordination as a Buddhist nun. The question that comes to my mind, why didn't Visakha, he was a non-returner, now he didn't have a wife anymore, why didn't he become a Buddhist monk? I don't know the answer to that, and the commentary doesn't give an answer. There's no mention made of them having children that he would have to bring up. Maybe he had parents to look after. I don't know. But anyway, Visakha made all of the arrangements for Dhammadina to take ordination. She became a bhikkhuni. Then she went out of Rajagaha to some quiet hermitage and practiced meditation for some time. And then in the course of her practice, she attained realization, full realization, and she became an arahant. Okay, then after some time, she came back to the capital city of Rajagaha, and then Visakha heard that she had come back, and he wanted to go to her and find out the level of her realization. And so he came to her to pose certain, not to ask her directly, did you realize this, did you realize that, but to ask her a number of questions which will test her level of realization. Okay, so it's with this that the sutta, the Chulavedala Sutta, begins.
(Clears throat)
Okay, so now Visakha has come to the Bhikkhuni Dhammadina, and after paying respects to her, then he asks the first question. Okay, the first question, he first repeats a word that is used in the Buddha's teaching. This word is Sakkaya. It's a word that's very difficult to translate exactly into English, even though it's a very simple word. The main part of the word is kaya, which means literally body. Then it has a prefix, sak. But this prefix, oh, I should have put it this way. The prefix could be sat. I think originally the real prefix is sat. The word sat means real or existing. Maybe existing is better. And so satkaya would mean literally existing body. But the other derivation, the one that the commentaries give, is sa plus kaya. The word sa means own, one's own. And then kaya is body. So sakkaya is literally one's own body. Interestingly, the Chinese translator of the Zhonghan Jing also seemed to prefer this derivation, since they translate it zi shan, one's own body. But here, though, the word body, usually in the text, it refers to the physical body. But the word kaya actually suggests the idea of a totality. So the body, as we normally use the word, is the totality of one's physical being. But we could also take body in another sense, like we speak of a body of people, as a group of people. And so here we could take sukhaya as maybe the best translation, a good translation, would be simply oneself. Not the self as some kind of metaphysical entity, but what one means when one speaks about oneself. In this translation, the published translation, I use the word identity, which I took from another translator, Venerable Thanissaro. Maybe it's all right tentatively, but it's important to know the original word and its derivation. It's So maybe the easiest way to understand it is, as I said, simply to take it as meaning oneself. Not in the sense of the atta, the atman, but just what one is referring to when one speaks about oneself in the ordinary sense of the word. Okay, so now Visakha is asking the Bhikkhuni Dhammadina, he's saying, it is said in ordinary discourse, we say, oneself, oneself. What is it that is called oneself by the Blessed One? What is one's actual identity? Okay, then Dhammadina, the nun Dhammadina replies, friend Visakha, these five aggregates affected by clinging or bound up with clinging are called identity or oneself by the Blessed One, by the Buddha. So what are these five aggregates? There is the aggregate of material form, the aggregate of feeling, the aggregate of perception, the aggregate of the mental formations or volitional formations. This aggregate includes a large number of mental factors that are connected with will or volition or desire. And then there is the consciousness aggregate affected by clinging. Okay, so when the Buddha speaks about identity, about oneself, what one actually is, then he is referring to these five aggregates which are bound up with clinging. Okay, it's sometimes said that when the Buddha speaks about a living being, he regards a living being as being an assemblage or a compound of the five aggregates. I don't think that this way of speaking is really technically correct, because when we speak about something being an assemblage or a compound, it suggests that the parts of which it's composed are capable of existing apart from the compound, and that one just takes them and puts them together to get the compound. Like we have a compound, even water is a compound, H2O, combination of two parts hydrogen, one part oxygen. And we could separate these two parts of water, and then we get atoms of hydrogen, atoms of oxygen. Correct? Anybody know chemistry better than I do? I was going to be a chemist when I was in high school. Okay, but even though we find material form existing separately, but we don't find feeling, perception, volitions, consciousness existing separately, and then we put them together, and then we get a living being out of these five constituents. So the way I see it is that a living being is always a functional unity. But we can take the living being and analyze it into these five constituents, components. Well, we could take the way I prefer to explain the five aggregates is to take experience as the starting point and then analyze experience into these four different constituents of an experience, of an occasion of experience. And so in any occasion of experience, we have these five different aspects, where we can look at an experience from five different angles. So let us say we have an experience of hearing a telephone ring. Okay, so on this occasion, there is the aspect of material form. This would be my physical body, and especially in hearing the telephone, there is the ear, which is now playing the most prominent role. And then there's also the object, since the five aggregates include all phenomena that fit into that particular category. So material form refers not only to the physical body, not only to what's internal to oneself, but also to what is external, to external form. So there is, when hearing the telephone ring, there is the sound, which is external, and there is the telephone itself. So that would be the aspect of the form aggregate present on that occasion. Okay, then there is, let me take what's most prominent when one hears the telephone ring. We come directly to the perception aggregate, since one perceives the sound. And so one hears the sound of the telephone ringing, one identifies this as the sound of a telephone. That act of identification, that perception of the sound together with the identification of it, this is the functioning of the perception aggregate. We say this is an occasion of perception. Then this perception will be associated with a particular feeling. If I'm expecting a telephone call from a friend to make some appointment for maybe going out together to do something that we are planning to do, then the feeling will be one of pleasure. I'm delighted to have this telephone call come through. If I've been evading paying my rent or my avoiding paying my rent, and I'd gotten several calls over the last few days from the landlord telling me your rent is due, you better pay or I'm going to kick you out, then the telephone rings. The feeling will be one of displeasure, painful feeling. Okay, when the telephone rings, if it's the expected call from the friend, then there'll be a particular volition, an act of will arising. If it's the call from the friend, the volition will be to pick up the telephone, to answer the telephone. If it's the expected call from the angry landlord, then the volition could be one of not wanting to answer the telephone, or volition answer it, but disguise your voice and tell the landlord, Bhikkhu Bodhi is not here today. He's gone out. Oh, he's moved to California. And then there'll be an awareness of all of this. Well, first, when the telephone is ringing and one is hearing it, to make that possible, there is the awareness that arises through the ear that is ear consciousness. So in this way, we can see that a particular experience can be analyzed into, we can speak of five constituents, five elements, but we shouldn't think that these five constituents are things that we could separate out and which have a capacity for existing independently apart from their unity in an act of experience. Rather, it's the case that we look at the experience and analyze it in terms of these five elements or five constituents. So I took one particular experience as an example, but we take all of our experiences or all possible experiences, and then in those experiences, any type of material form constitutes, or all these types, all these occasions of material form constitute the material form aggregate. All types of occasions of feeling constitute the feeling aggregate. That's why it's called an aggregate. It's a totality of all types of feelings. All types of perceptions constitute the perception aggregate. All types of volitions constitute the aggregate of volitional formations. And all types of consciousness constitute the aggregate of consciousness. Now, why does the Buddha give so much attention to these five aggregates? Why does he analyze a living being in terms of these five aggregates? The reason is that these five aggregates constitute the, we say, the domain, the sphere, the objective range of clinging. Clinging, the Pali word is upadana. And that which, so upadana is clinging, and that which clinging clings to, that which clinging holds to, is this totality of the five aggregates. In the Buddha's teaching on the Four Noble Truths, we find this in the first discourse, when the Buddha is explaining the noble truth of suffering, first he explains the types of suffering that are visible immediately, that immediately resonate with our understanding: birth, old age, sickness, death, separation from the loved, union with what is disagreeable, not to get what one wants. So these types of suffering we can read about, hear about, and immediately we can understand them. But then at the end of this exposition of suffering, the Buddha says, in short, in brief, the five aggregates subject to clinging are dukkha, or suffering. And so these five aggregates constitute the real meaning of the first noble truth. The other types of suffering that the Buddha mentions, we could say, are means, like a skillful means, to lead us to grasp the fact that the five aggregates as a whole are dukkha, are suffering. So when one is asked straight off to explain the real meaning of the first noble truth, to state it very concisely, one doesn't have to say birth, old age, illness, death, but one can just say straight off, the five aggregates bound up with clinging are suffering, or dukkha. Okay, so when the lay disciple Visakha asked Dhammadina what is meant by identity or oneself, the bhikkhuni Dhammadina explains by enumerating the five aggregates. And then Visakha delights in her words, and then asks another question. Now he asks the origin of identity, the origin of oneself, the root of one's existence. What is the origin of oneself, the origin of one's... What does the Buddha explain as the origin of oneself? Okay, what's meant by oneself are the five aggregates. So now what is it that brings these five aggregates into being? And here Visakha, Dhammadina replies, again she uses the exact words that are used in the Buddha's teaching on the Four Noble Truths to explain the origin of suffering. She says, it is craving which brings renewal of being, renewal of existence, which is accompanied by delight and lust, and delights in this and that, that is craving for sensual pleasures, craving for being or craving for existence, and craving for non-being, craving for annihilation. This is called the origin of identity, the origin of oneself by the Blessed One. This exchange helps us to understand more deeply With this answer, Dhammadina is explaining what it is that brings these five aggregates that constitute the living being, what brings these five aggregates into existence? Where do these five aggregates that constitute the stream of our experience, where do they come from? And the answer that Dhammadina gives is that they originate from craving. And how is it that craving could be the explanation for the existence of these five aggregates that constitute our being? The answer is that it is the craving from the previous existence, the craving continuing from the previous existence, that brings into being the new living being that constitutes ourself in this existence. When a living being passes away, what happens is that the body dies. The body can no longer function as the physical support for the stream of experience, the process of experience. But in an unenlightened being, there will still be ignorance and craving. Ignorance, we could say, is the deep, dark, underlying cause. And craving, I call it the propelling cause, the driving cause, the more dynamic cause. Ignorance is sort of like a blind spot in the eye, something that one doesn't see, but it is there nevertheless. But craving is like the driver at the wheel of the car, the driver that drives the stream of consciousness on from the moment of death. It drives it on into a new existence. And when craving is driving the stream of consciousness onto the new existence, it takes a particular direction, and that direction is determined by one's karma, by one's volitional actions. And so we have ignorance, craving, and karma, volitional activity, working in unison to drive the stream of consciousness on. And it is the craving which the Buddha has singled out as the origin, because it has that propelling role, that role of driving the stream of consciousness on to a new existence. It is the craving in order to enjoy more sensual pleasures, craving to continue in existence, to experience some new state of existence. Or it can even be the craving for non-being, the craving for annihilation. Even though there's a craving for annihilation, but because it's a blind, ignorant craving, it will lead to the continuation of becoming, of new existence. And craving, so to speak, deposits the seed into the new realm of existence. And that seed grows into this totality of the five aggregates that constitutes our being. And so it is from craving, pushing the stream of consciousness into a new existence, and then from craving, working together with karma, brings about the arising of this totality of the five aggregates that we call myself. And then this totality of the five aggregates, this is what the Buddha calls dukkha, the first noble truth. Okay, so then we have the next question, Visakha says cessation of identity. Cessation of identity. What is called the cessation of identity by the Blessed One? In other words, what is the ending of these five aggregates that are afflicted by dukkha, or that make up the truth of dukkha, the truth of suffering? And again, the wording that's given here is taken straight out of the Buddha's first discourse in explaining the cessation of suffering. Dhammadina says, it is the remainderless fading away and ceasing of that same craving, giving it up, relinquishing it, letting it go, and rejecting it, or freedom from it. This is called the cessation of identity, the cessation of oneself by the Blessed One. So this follows quite naturally and logically. And then the next question, what is the way leading to the cessation of identity? And then the answer given is that it is just this Noble Eightfold Path, right view, sitter, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. Again, the answer is taken from the Buddha's first discourse. So we can see that this conversation, if we look at this conversation, we see that it is actually patterned, or is actually constructed according to the pattern of the Four Noble Truths. Except instead of explaining in terms of suffering the way the Buddha does in the first sermon, the four items are explained in terms of identity or oneself, or simply in terms of the five aggregates. First, we have the five aggregates, their origin, their cessation, and the way leading to the cessation. And from this, we could see, especially from the explanation of the Second Noble Truth, that the Four Noble Truths are not just speaking about a psychological phenomenon, about the experience of grief, worry, distress arising from craving, but they're actually speaking about the totality of conditioned existence, which is represented by the five aggregates. And what brings about the arising of conditioned existence? It is craving from some earlier life. So craving brings about new existence. This new existence is constituted by the five aggregates. Within the five aggregates, there is new craving, more craving. As long as that craving continues, it brings about arising of another set of five aggregates. Within that new set of five aggregates, there's ignorance and craving. Again, that ignorance and craving will bring about another existence constituted of the five aggregates. And so the sequence goes on from life to life to life until craving is eliminated. When craving is eliminated, then this process of repeated becoming comes to an end. And the way to eliminate that craving is through cultivating the Noble Eightfold Path. Okay, now Visakha asks a very subtle and tricky question. We speak about Panch Upadana Khanda. Let me put this on the board. Okay, in Pali, you see, when we translate five aggregates, yeah, I followed Nyanamoli, who had affected by clinging. In my later translation, I've changed this to five aggregates subject to clinging. Sometimes I translate it or explain it, five aggregates bound up with clinging. But the Pali expression is simply pancha upadana khanda, which pancha means five, upadana means clinging, and khanda means aggregates. And so, when we take the expression just translated literally, we have the problem of trying to figure out what exactly is the relation of upadana to these five aggregates. How do we understand this expression? And so I think this is what lies behind the next question that Visakha is going to ask. He asks, he says, "Lady, is that clinging the same as these five aggregates subject to clinging?" Let me put it, translate it more literally. Is that clinging the same as these five clinging aggregates? Or is the clinging something apart from the five clinging aggregates? The Pali has tanyeva upadhanang te pancha upadhana khanda. Is that clinging itself the five clinging aggregates, udahu, or anyatra panchahi upadhana khandehi upadhanam? Or is there clinging apart from the five aggregates, from the five clinging aggregates? So that is the question. Then Dhammadina replies, in a way you could say Visakha has set up a dilemma. Is it A or is it B? And, or is it A or is it not A? And then Dhammadina rejects both of the alternatives presented by Visakha. She says that clinging is not the same as the five clinging aggregates. But on the other hand, clinging is not something existing apart from the five clinging aggregates. Rather, it is the desire and lust in regard to the five aggregates. Let me go back. It is the desire and lust in regard to the five clinging aggregates that is the clinging there. So this desire and lust, that is the meaning of clinging. Desire and lust, in other words, it is the attachment to the five aggregates. That is the clinging there. And where does that attachment, that desire and lust, where does it exist? Right. It exists within one of the five aggregates, and within that particular the particular aggregate in which it exists is the aggregate of volitional formations. So it's just one particular factor, or actually it turns out to be two particular factors within the aggregate of volitional formations that constitutes the clinging to the five clinging aggregates. If we take the first alternative that Visakha presented, if clinging is the same as the five clinging aggregates, that would mean that bodily form, feeling, perception, volitional formations, and consciousness, all five of them are types of clinging. So just to feel would mean that there is clinging. Just to have any perception would mean that there's clinging. Just to be conscious, the very act of consciousness would be a clinging. Even the body itself would be clinging. But if the clinging could exist apart from the five aggregates, then it would be impossible to explain how clinging interacts with our ordinary experience. It would seem to exist in a realm of its own. But the clinging is not identical with the five aggregates, and it's not something apart from the five aggregates, but it is something within the five aggregates that is responsible for the holding to them. And what is responsible for that holding to the five aggregates is what is called here desire and lust. In other words, this is attachment. But I said that there are actually two factors that are responsible for clinging. Here, Dhammadina has focused on one of them, which is the factor of attachment. But there's another factor, and that is the factor of views, distorted views. And that is what will come in the next part of the dialogue. But maybe I should at this point open up to questions. Yeah, Peter.
Just to follow up on a point you just made, where you said that clinging can't exist apart from the five aggregates. It seems to be right. So I'm wondering about, and maybe there's not a good answer to the question, I'm wondering about the Buddha's conception of causation, since in an ordinary Western view, the cause needs to be distinct from the effect in order to have cause.
Yeah.
So if the clinging can't exist apart from the five aggregates because it's in some sense one of them, then is there some kind of process, a continuous process view whereby clinging gives rise to a new set of aggregates? Do you understand my question? In other words, if the clinging is always a part of a system of aggregates. Maybe it's not. Maybe it has a separate kind of existence.
No, I would say that the clinging is part of the system of the aggregates.
Okay. So,
but it's not identical with the aggregates in their totality, yeah.
So in terms of the causal relations, wouldn't the cause have to be separate from the thing, its result, in order to have causal influence on it?
I'm not sure that this is a case of causation, at least maybe the way I'm understanding your problem. This is a case of clinging, holding to the five aggregates. So clinging will exist simultaneously with the five aggregates. Okay, so there's a clinging to material, to bodily form, material form. There's a clinging to feeling, clinging to perceptions, and there's a clinging to volitions. Even, I would say, a clinging to clinging itself. Wait, and a clinging to consciousness. So these are taking place simultaneously. The clinging is taking place simultaneously with the five aggregates. But the five aggregates provide, I call this, the field for clinging to operate.
I was thinking of the origin of oneself question.
Okay, in that case, we say the clinging and the craving are almost the same. In that case, the clinging or craving, it's part of the five aggregates, and it never exists separate from the five aggregates, but it is the craving in the five aggregates of one life. Okay, what happens at death is that the bodily aggregate loses, the life faculty is exhausted, life comes to an end. But there is still that craving there to go on experiencing. And so it's that craving, it's continuing with the mental process, the mental stream. And that craving brings about the arising of a new set of five aggregates that constitutes the next existence. And then within that new set of five aggregates, there still will be craving, a craving for sense pleasures and so on. And then a clinging to the five aggregates will still be there, even though it might not, the clinging doesn't become sort of conceptually explicit until a person, the being, achieves some degree of maturity. But the clinging is always, always there. Yes, Carol? Okay, that's a good way to express it. One could say that the clinging is interdependent with the five aggregates.
Yeah. And what continues, the continued existence of the craving and the mental consciousness, is that what is also called the alaya?
Okay, maybe state the question again. Okay, what continues to create the basis for a new existence?
Yeah, is that what is known as the alaya?
Yeah, first, the alaya this is the alaya vijnana. This was a concept which actually came in at a relatively late phase in the development of Indian Buddhist philosophy in order to explain how karma operates and where karma is stored. It's typical only of a particular school of Buddhism or one particular system of Buddhist thought, the Yogacara school of Buddhism. So in the early texts, we don't have a concept of the alaya vijnana. That developed later. You could say that it developed maybe as an attempt to give some systematic explanation to how, the factors in the mind create the continuity of the world and of experience from life to life. But the early texts don't posit something like one particular type of consciousness which has that function, but it's just consciousness is always interacting with craving, with karma, and with ignorance. And so it's through the interaction of these factors that the process continues from life to life. Yeah, Connie?
I have a question with regard to clinging and the five aggregates being part and parcel of the same thing. What happens in the case of an enlightened being who has eradicated clinging and craving? Are there still not five aggregates?
Yeah. Okay, that's a good question. What happens with to these five aggregates of clinging in regard to an enlightened being? Okay, what's happened is that the clinging is eradicated, or craving is eradicated, ignorance are eradicated, but the five aggregates still remain, so that the enlightened being still has five aggregates, but this is a knotty question. Whether they're still to be called Panchupadana Khanda. I haven't found this question actually addressed very explicitly in the suttas. Using the Abhidhamma text as a way to answer it, what I find is that even for an enlightened being, the five aggregates are called Panchupadana Khanda, not in the sense that there's any more upadana, no clinging, there's no clinging there anymore, but they're called five aggregates of clinging in the sense that they were produced by clinging. So even though an enlightened being eliminates clinging, so there's no longer clinging in the five aggregates, but there's still form, feeling, perception, mental formations and consciousness.
Until that life
ends,
there will be no more creation.
Yeah. And those five aggregates, the way the question is treated in the Abhidhamma, they're still called five clinging aggregates in the sense that they were produced by past clinging. Yeah, George. Yeah. Yeah, that's an interesting point, just to get it into the recording. George points out that in the formula of dependent origination, a distinction is made between craving and clinging, whereas in the discussion here, the two seem to be conflated. Clinging, upadana, is defined as desire and lust. This is chanda and raga, which are elsewhere used almost as synonyms for craving. What seems to me to be the case is that craving and clinging are actually very close, but the way they're explained in dependent origination, craving is actually not really defined, but it's just analyzed into what is craving. Craving for forms, craving for sounds, craving for sounds, odors, tastes, tactile objects, craving for mental objects. So it's just not really defined, but just distinguished according to its object. Okay, but then the question is brought up, what is clinging? And then one type of clinging is clinging to sensual pleasures. But then the other three types of clinging are more on the side of views, distorted views. There is the clinging to views, there's clinging to, call a sila bhatta, to rules and observances, which is actually explained to be the view that by following particular rules and undertaking particular observances, one could gain liberation. And it's taken to be the view of the outside Brahmins and ascetics. And then there is the clinging to a doctrine of self, which is the view of self. And so within the formula of dependent origination, clinging is explained in a way which gives a certain degree of prominence to the element of views within clinging. So there's both the clinging to sense pleasures and clinging to views. Whereas the way clinging is explained here, it's just the weight is put on the clinging, almost as identical with craving. And then the way the Abhidhamma analyzes clinging and craving, it says that craving is the one mental factor which is called lobha, greed. But clinging is two mental factors. The clinging to sense pleasures is the mental factor of greed. And then the other three types of clinging are the mental factor of views. So the way the Abhidhamma treats mental factors, craving is just one mental factor, greed, and then clinging are the two mental factors, greed, you say intensified greed, because it's following craving, and then views, because on account of this craving, one formulates certain views and then clings to these views and propagates them. Any further questions? Okay, if no more questions, then before we end, I want to make an announcement. A number of us recently or some months ago, we decided to get together and form a Buddhist organization for the purpose of helping poor people around the world, people who are oppressed by poverty, by societal neglect, people throughout the world, but initially focusing on people in the Buddhist countries of Asia. We call this organization Buddhist Global Relief. And we decided to make our initial mission to focus on the problem of global hunger. This is a problem which is now affecting some 900 million people. 900 million people around the world are suffering from chronic hunger, malnutrition, which bring many diseases, premature death. And of all of these people suffering from chronic hunger, 60% of them are children. So that means, like a billion people, 500, 600 million children around the world are going hungry. So we've formed this organization called Buddhist Global Relief, and we're trying to expand our activities, and to do so, we need more help. If there's anybody here who has a background or experience in relief work, charity work, social welfare work, fundraising, and would like to help us, please feel welcome to join our efforts. I think, Marcy, do you have any of the brochures? Because I've used them all up. I gave them all away on last Saturday. But if you want to find out more about the organization, you can go to our website. The website address is www.buddhistglobalrelief, all is one word, .org. And even if you don't have experience in the particular fields that I mentioned, but you would like to contribute in some way, contribute help, still you're welcome if you think you can pick up the necessary skills. If you would like to join our efforts, please speak to Marcy. I think everybody here knows Marcy. But you don't have to make a decision right away. You can check out the website to find out more about the organization and then decide later. But we do need more help, particularly, I think, in the area of fundraising and what other areas do you think?
All areas,
yeah. Promotion.
Word processing. Microsoft Word, Excel.
People who know how to use Microsoft Excel?
All of that.
Yeah. Okay, so let us end by sharing the merits. Okay, and then we have the next class before we do the sharing of the merits. Next class will be next Tuesday. That will be, today is the 21st, October 28th. So please come for the continuation of the Chula Vedala Sutta. Okay, we end by sharing the merits with the devas, the deities, the nagas, the dragon spirits, the buddhas, the protective spirits, asking them to protect the Dharma, to protect the world, to protect ourselves and others. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahidika punyantang anumodiva chirang rakantu sasanang. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahidika punyantang anumodiva chirang rakantu desanang. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahidika punyantang anumodiva chirang rakantu mang parang. Etavata cha amhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe devanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavata cha amhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe bhutanu dantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavata cha amhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe sata anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya.